Hi there. Thank you for joining me on this conversation. For those listening to this as a podcast, welcome to our second episode of the series. My name is Rue, and I'm a senior associate at Winkworth Sherwood's Charities and Social Enterprises team. I am absolutely thrilled to invite Roger Davis as our guest today, who I must say is certainly no stranger to a podcast or two. Rodri is a well-known thinker and commentator on philanthropy and civil society. You may know or heard of Rodri from his popular philanthropism podcast. He is also the founding director of the think tank Why Philanthropy Matters and a Peers Research Fellow at the Centre for Philanthropy at the University of Kent. Rodri was formerly the head of policy at the Charities Aid Foundation, where he created and led the in-house think tank Giving Thought and hosted their popular Giving Thought podcasts. Now, on a personal level, I have closely followed Rodri's work over the past 8 years, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying that he has really inspired me to start my own journey, certainly my own podcast journey, and work in this area of law. Okay, fan doodling aside, Roger, a very warm welcome to this conversation. It is really a privilege to have you on today.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
Roger, I've touched on a little bit just now on your current roles, but it would be lovely if you could share with us on your own journey into the world of philanthropy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, like a lot of people, this journey's into philanthropy as a sort of healthy dose of luck and an accident. It's not one of those areas in which people often kind of carefully plan out a career, although increasingly I guess people do have kind of more set career paths. In my case, it was because I thought I was going to be an academic, a particularly sort of obscure type of philosopher. I was doing lots of stuff around the philosophy of maths, and was kind of embarking on doing a PhD in that. I realized I didn't actually want to spend the whole of the rest of my career in quite such an odd little niche. And so I had a kind of existential crisis of wondering what to do. And I ended up thinking, well, the stuff I'm good at is kind of academic research, writing, that sort of thing, joining the dots between different areas. Is there a way I could do that, but in more of a real world setting? So I managed eventually to get a job in a think tank. And it so happened that the project I joined to work on was one about philanthropy in the City of London. And I got it because I'd been working in another place doing a bit of sort of corporate headhunting. And so I had some knowledge of financial services at the time. And, I didn't at that point think I knew or cared anything about philanthropy. And so I sort of merrily set off to do lots of interviews with very senior investment bankers and hedge fund managers and others about, their giving. And it was an amazing grounding and kind of learning all about the various issues to do with philanthropy. And I found it absolutely fascinating. I was hooked, and I went on to do a couple more projects about philanthropy there. And then, that led on to getting the job at CAF, where I was for just over a decade. And during the course of that, got ever more deeply into the weeds on issues around philanthropy, including kind of looking back at the history and thinking ahead about what's coming in the future. And that's the space I've very much stayed in.
Excellent. And it certainly sounds like you've moved from one very niche area to one somewhat niche area. And I'd love to touch on sort of your thoughts on some of the big trends in philanthropy in just in a moment. But could you talk a little bit about your work at Why Philanthropy Matters?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I left CAF in, when was it, 2021? So like a lot of people, I mean, I've been there a long time anyway. So I was thinking about, what the next step was. And like a lot of people during the pandemic, it kind of made you reassess things. I was fortunate in a way that I'd been working remotely and from home for quite a long time anyway. So it wasn't as much of a culture shock to me on that front. But I was kind of thinking about where to go next and why how I wanted to kind of focus more on the in-depth research and sort of thinking about some of the big picture issues about philanthropy that I was able to do in my work at CAF, but also I had kind of other competing priorities there. And I was fortunate I was able to kind of find a few different things, including working with the Pairs Foundation, the job that I do at the University of Kent. And then the other thing that I did was start to set up a new entity called Why Philanthropy Matters, which is a website and a think tank, which launched almost exactly a year ago, actually. And that was, intended as a place where I could pull together a lot of the sort of work that I've been doing, the podcast, articles, writing, and that sort of thing, exploring issues around philanthropy. And the idea really is longer term for that to be somewhere where that can develop its own independent existence and identity that's not just me. And so hopefully my ambition is really that I can kind of bring other people on board and act as a space where lots of people can kind of use it to explore and discuss some of these kind of big picture issues about philanthropy.
Yeah, oh, that's excellent. What a noble intention is, Audrey. Well, at this stage, I want to just also just bring up this book, which you may recognise as you authored it. What is Philanthropy For? And I really had the pleasure of reading this. And it only came out, I think, March this year. And I think in this very short book, you've adeptly presented quite a holistic view, in my opinion, on philanthropy, charting its origins with some very illuminating examples and interesting historical anecdotes. You really do put philanthropy in context. And what really drew out to me was in your book, you mentioned that finding an exact definition of philanthropy that we can all agree on is hard. Mm. And to be honest, without sort of examining some of the debates in this area and listening to your amazing podcasts, as a layperson myself, you know, surely to me, a definition is easy to arrive at. You know, doesn't it just mean the love of humanity? And I personally wouldn't be necessarily inclined, even though I practice in this area of law, to sort of delve any deeper than that and look at its applications in context. And I think your book, certainly, and your podcast series does just do that. It puts it into context and actually asks us the question what philanthropy is, and you present that very well and you show us what it isn't actually. And I really like how the book is divided into different chapters looking at the relationship between philanthropy and charity, which to be honest, I at one point in time thought it was just synonymous. Mm. I thought, isn't charity philanthropy? Philanthropy and justice, philanthropy and state, market and democracy. And I think what I've learned a lot from your book and from your work is where we think something, a notion is new in philanthropy, you very quickly dismantle that. You go, hold on a second, actually, if we just look back in history, and sometimes not even that far back, you certainly point out, actually, this has been done before. So yeah. It's not as new as you think. So thank you for that. A very nice summary of your sort of career today and what your mission is, I guess. On that note, could you share with us some big trends that you've sort of spotted in philanthropy at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, doing the book was great in a way from that point of view, because as you say, it's, you know, working on this stuff all the time. But the brief for the book, particularly because it's part of a wider series of sort of short introductions, so there are other kind of what is it for guides, mm-hmm. you know, it had a relatively tight word count. The reason it's at the length that it is not because I left to my own devices would have written a book that length. It would have been three or four times longer. But it's right. Actually a good discipline to be set, you know, to be set the challenge of having to outline what some of the key debates and issues are in a pretty pithy style for a kind of general interested audience. I mean, I think in terms of the trends that we're that are kind of, you know, front of mind for me at the moment, as you say, a lot of them are the classic ones that are always there in philanthropy and are to some extent kind of inherent in the whole idea of what philanthropy is. But the thing that's been really interesting for me is that it feels as though a lot of those debates have become much more open within the world of philanthropy, and actually in some cases even kind of leaked out into the mainstream, and people are sort of talking about this stuff much more openly. I mean, some of those are things like, you know, examining the question of power within philanthropy and the idea that actually, no matter how well-intentioned, if we're talking about philanthropy in the sense of people who have resources using them to try and help people who don't necessarily have access to resources, even when you transfer the money or, you know, the other kinds of philanthropic resources, there can still be quite uncomfortable imbalances of power. You know, does that limit the ability of philanthropy sometimes to address inequality or to kind of drive fundamental systemic change? And can we find ways of doing philanthropy that actually do rebalance power as well as money? And that's where I think, you know, some of the conversations that are going on about things like participatory grant making are really fascinating, because it kind of flips the model on its head a little bit. I mean, a couple of the other things I'm really interested in, I think the I mean, one of the oldest questions about philanthropy that still very much vexes people is the whole question of whether where the money's come from in the first place kind of has an impact on the legitimacy of trying to do good through giving it away. And there's a whole history of debate about the idea that some donations are tainted because the way in which they've been made, you know, creates ethical challenges and problems in society that sort of undermine the efforts to do good through giving them away. And, you know, the most recent well-known example is the Sackler family and all the controversy about their donations. But it, you can find examples, you know, many more examples now and lots of examples through history. I, you know, I talk to fundraisers and people working in universities and kind of arts and cultural institutions and others a lot about this. And in fact, I was giving a talk for a university course in Canada on Monday, and we ended up having a really long conversation about tainted donations because it's something that really gets people talking, because you know, it's a difficult one to that fundamental question of, you know, do, if money is seen as bad in some way, first of all, like, do we all agree why it's bad and that it's bad? But then what do you do about it? Is it better to take the bad money and try and do good with it? Or is it, does that kind of compromise you morally as well? And it's, that's a really hard question. And then the other thing, I think, I mean, there's lots of others, but that I'm interested in and have been for a while and probably doing more work on now as well is on looking ahead at the impact that technology is going to have on philanthropy and civil society, and the role that philanthropy and civil society can also play in kind of shaping how we develop technology. Because I think obviously things are moving so rapidly in the technology space, and I'm not sure the thinking about how that links with philanthropy is moving quite as quickly as we need it to. So I think there's a lot more to be said there.
Oh, that's a really interesting overview. And I'd love to just have a quick chat to you about AI and tech in a while. Just unpick a few things you said just now, some of the bigger trends, and actually from what you said, it's existing trends that have sustained the test of time. So these debates are still alive. And what you said about tainted donations is an interesting one. And I've listened to quite a few of your own sort of podcasts on this topic. And I think in a recent episode you recorded with the lady who works in human rights, and I think it's called Human Rights and Philanthropy. She made an interesting point about how it's important to distinguish between sort of bad money and bad donor. So those two distinctions is quite interesting as well. And, you know, what, you know, from your book, I think you quoted George Bernard Shaw to say how it's difficult, actually, if you're going to be very black and white about tainted money, it's actually difficult to find genuine clean money in society.
And I think Shaw's a really interesting one on that, because he's not saying it's all okay, but he's very pragmatic. He kind of says, you know, the idea that individual coins can be seen as tainted is a sort of, you know, an individualist superstition, he says. He's like, as soon as you start questioning some money, where do you stop? And actually people make that argument now. It's the sort of pragmatic, well, you know, apart from those cases where it clearly is beyond the pale because, you know, sanctions have been imposed or laws have been broken, or where it clearly runs directly contrary to a charity's mission. You know, if you're a health charity, for instance, it's not a very difficult decision to say we won't take money from the tobacco industry, for instance. But there's a lot of gray area where, you know, you might have reservations about some money for various reasons, but actually, you know, how do you say that that money's not okay, and then something else that's very close but not quite the same is okay? And it does become quite difficult to draw firm dividing lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you do recommend a very pragmatic, and I think that's a key word here, almost a checklist on what sort of to do. And it's very individualistic, and it's a case-by-case basis. There is no one-size-fits-all when it comes to this, but the concern you mentioned is a real one, because of, you know, you don't want to receive tainted money as, you know, as a way that is washes reputation of the donor, so that, you know, it comes out clean and they do something good. So that's a very real concern. And the first point you made about you know, plutocratic bias, And the fact that, you know, in order to have a democracy and to ensure that, you know, we're sustaining equitable change, you need to have a participatory, involved philanthropy so that, you know, we're not just giving away, in your book, I think you say giving away money, but you ensure that you're not, the power that you're also giving away as well in tandem with the money that you're giving to these charities. So that's a very interesting point. On that note, I want to just touch on what you mentioned about the role of technology and AI and what sort of you see this developing, this landscape. Do you, where do you see the future going with this?
I think, I mean, it's really interesting. I think in terms of philanthropy and emerging technology, I kind of ended up talking about this stuff and doing a lot of work on it initially because of getting an interest in cryptocurrency and blockchain. And that was really instructive, I think, for two reasons. One was it was a good lesson in the value of learning enough about technology to be credible and understand that and to understand its features so that you can then sort of apply it to the, you know, the domain that you have expertise in. So actually think, what are the affordances of this technology? You know, what does it enable you to do? What incentives does it introduce? And how does that relate to what grant makers do and philanthropists and charities? Mm-hmm. And you know, there clearly was value in that. And we did a lot of work on that when I was at CAF. And then mm-hmm. we sort of took the same approach and you know, 6 or 7 years ago and started talking about artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, it felt, I think, a bit speculative and science fictionist mm-hmm. to lots of people. And, you know, that's very much not the case anymore. The useful thing for having gone through that experience with cryptocurrency and blockchain is I saw the full spread of the cycle where actually you realize the danger of how much hype there is around a lot of these technologies as well. And, you know, I talked to and was kind of engaged with lots of people who made very, very overblown claims about the impact that, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrency might have on philanthropy. And I probably, you know, was guilty of getting a bit carried away at times myself earlier on. And then I sort of over time realized that actually very little of that had panned out into reality. So you do have to take these things with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
I guess the interesting thing to me about AI is it does feel different in that genuine, you know, this technology genuinely is already having an impact and is being mm-hmm. implemented in lots of different ways across society. And mm-hmm. some of that feels positive. You know, there are some pretty amazing tools out there already. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. people are aware of things like ChatGPT, but there are other mm-hmm. generative AI tools for mm-hmm. you know, text to image generation. There's lots of productivity tools that can do all kinds of things that at the moment take up valuable human time. So mm-hmm. there might be lots of opportunities to harness those.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're also aware there are going to be some problems, and we're already seeing some of that in terms of, you know, the tendency for these systems to exhibit bias or to kind of propagate misinformation and to give sort of false answers.
Yeah.
And we need to get much savvier, I think, about that mm-hmm. in the philanthropy and charity world mm-hmm. and figure out how charities protect themselves from those challenges, but also, even more importantly, what they need to do to protect the people and communities that they work with from those same challenges, because I think that's going to be a big part of the work of funders and charities in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with you there. And if I touch on what you mentioned about cryptocurrency and how at the beginning, I know you've worked on this for over a decade now.
Yeah.
Very much at the inception when this thing sort of first arose. And how it's sort of overblown. And what's interesting is that the Charity Commission have published a cryptocurrency blog, I think July last year, and they've noted some uses at the moment of cryptocurrency in the charity sphere, but it's a very limited usage. So they've noted like the Ukrainian government raised millions of via cryptocurrency for its war efforts. And there was even an announcement I read back then that they were going to, the Treasury was going to make UK a global, they call it a global crypto asset technology hub.
Yeah, yeah.
with a legislation to follow on that.
Yeah.
So we await that. And so the uses, at least in this country, has been very limited. And there's been some also interesting, as an observer, scandals as well in the charity sphere on crypto philanthropy. So Orfano, you may have seen, I think I heard in your podcast, Wikimedia as well, how that failed. And there's definitely some concerns you've drawn out as well, which is true, about knowing your customer checks, due diligence checks, how that's near impossible For crypto assets, because the purpose of it is to conceal the identity of the donor. So as a charity, it in a way links to our talk earlier on tainted donations.
Yeah.
How would you even assess where that wealth generation came from, because it's concealed, no one knows. So that's an interesting sort of problem to overcome, I guess, in the future. So what you said about AI is also very interesting. And I think in this country, certainly the white paper that we've got very much is pro innovation. It's light touch at the moment, regulation, and the government currently sees AI as more of an opportunity, creating economic opportunity. And I saw in March, the ICO even issued some guidance around data protection to help complement this. But I do know that in the EU, they are looking to create a stricter regime. There's a new AI Act that's going to come out, and it's going to assign applications, these AI apps, into three risk categories. So those are unacceptable, those are more acceptable. So it's, you know, I await that development to see how that progresses. And you mentioned about ChatGPT. I mean, unless we've been living under a rock, it's hard to miss the development on ChatGPT. I read that some 300 billion words were fed into the system in order to train these things. So these are, you know, super intelligent in terms of words. It has so much information, well, all the information that's stored on the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
But of course, as you mentioned, it's subject to bias, because it's the information that we fed them this information, you know, we inputted it and we trained, and, you know, us humans will have our own biases, and there's biases on the internet, there's stereotypes and things like that. So it remains to be seen how, you know, that is going to be regulated, and it's already, I've seen studies that it's already shown to discriminate against ethnic minorities and Black people. But what did give me a bit of optimism when looking into this stuff is I saw a report by, I think, Dr. Kate Darling of MIT, and she, in a more positive way, has shown how ChatGPT and generative AI can be used to counter hate speech, because they can then identify if you, you know, ask, you know, offensive question to it, it can give you a more sort of an appropriate response to try and make you think about, well, why have you asked that question? So that's an interesting, you know, hopeful development that will progress. So we've touched on discrimination risks, obviously data protection risks you sort of mentioned, and human rights, because again, these things, you know, our privacy is at risk because it shares data. You know, when we subscribe to ChatGPT, that I think the default mode is that, you know, we share data, so potentially our personal data, financial data is shared. So there's a question mark over how, you know, that can, you know, be resolved in the future. You know, do we just turn off sharing data? And then if we do that, is that going to limit the usage? And who's accountable, you know? And, you know, I'm interested in your thoughts about accountability, because, you know, if something goes wrong, Audrey, with our ChatGPT, you know, who are we going to sue? Are we going to sue the company that's you know, implemented technology, or are we going to, you know, sue the individual user? A bit like, you know, driverless cars. So I'm interested in your sort of, you know, it's a hard one, isn't it, Audrey?
No, it is, but it's, I mean, I think it's a good point about accountability, because, I mean, we're already seeing with cases of sort of misinformation, so accidentally provided false information rather than disinformation. So with ChatGPT, for instance, I mean, there've been a few cases so far of lawyers using it to develop defense cases, and then finding that actually some of the precedent they're relying on is just made up, is fictional. And other people who found themselves subject to, you know, false or salacious claims about, you know, incidents that they've been involved in that ChatGPT has sort of provided in answers to other people. And they, some of them, particularly where there's defamation involved, have so far taken out lawsuits against OpenAI, because obviously they developed the tool. I think, you know, as these things become more embedded in the everyday technology, and particularly in sort of search functionality, the question of accountability is going to get harder, because I think the idea that there, you know, there is one company that sort of owns them and is responsible for them, you know, if you were at OpenAI, you might say, well, yeah, we created the algorithm, but we didn't train it. You know, the training is, you know, the data's at fault for this. I guess, you know, there's some interesting work going on around, at the very least, how do you make these things either transparent so that they don't operate as black boxes, or explainable in the sense of, you know, let's not just open them up, let's make them things that you can interrogate and sort of find out what's going on. And I think, you know, those are the sorts of areas where philanthropy and civil society could play more of a role, because actually, mm-hmm. if you appreciate the wider societal impact of this technology, yeah. that's the kind of stuff that we need to be doing. Mm-hmm. And they're probably, you know, philanthropy isn't currently as involved as it could be on that advocacy side of things.
Yeah.
The interesting, just in terms of the potential dangers of this, a couple of the examples that have come out recently around generative AI that I thought were really, really interesting. One was the use of ChatGPT in the US by a nonprofit, the National Eating Disorders Association, which mm-hmm. decided to replace all of its human call center operators with a ChatGPT based system. Depressingly, the reason they did that was that the call center operators wanted to unionize, and this nonprofit said, "Well, no, we'll just fire you all instead."
Yeah.
But they were about 2 days off releasing that system, and then they had to pull the plug because in the testing, it was pointed out to them by the experts who were testing it that it was giving out information and advice that was actively harmful to people with eating disorders. Sort of entirely would clearly sort of trigger very, very negative sort of self-harming behavior. And so, you know, you need to be very careful about implementing these tools. And then the other example I thought was really interesting was a couple of months ago, there was a big sort of kerfuffle because one of the country branches of Amnesty, I think it was the Swedish branch, they were putting out a report or a sort of some information about police brutality in Colombia. And they put a tweet out about this, but they illustrated it using an image that was generated by AI. And it said at the bottom, clearly image generated by AI, of a woman being brutalized by a police officer. Mm. And, you know, the reason they did this was they didn't want an image of a particular person, obviously, given the nature of the image. Yeah. But lots of people then said, hang on a minute, you know, you're asking us to believe in the authenticity of this information mm-hmm. and to take mm-hmm. action on it. But, you know, the fact that you've used an image that's generated by AI kind of undermines your authenticity in making that claim. And you need to be very careful about that sort of thing. So I think there are going to be all kinds of practical and ethical challenges we have to face up to.
Absolutely. Actually, at the time of this recording, our employment team hosted a webinar looking at data protection AI in the workplace, looking at some of what Roger and I discussed just now on AI and what does AI and automation in the workplace look like, surveillance and transparency and AI and discrimination. I will provide a link to that recording in the show notes as well, just to give some of this discussion context. What I guess I'm more hopeful that I've seen on this, despite the case studies that you've mentioned, is I'm not sure whether you've come across Charity Excellence Framework, Roger.
Yes, I have.
So it's founded by Ian McClintock, and it's started off as just a charity providing sort of free online databases, finding a funder, but they've now evolved to provide free AI services, free AI training. And I don't know whether you've tried, they've got a little tech bunny generated by sort of ChatGPT, and you can ask the bunny any questions. And they don't take or process personal information. They also launched a funding bid service. So for smaller charities that cannot afford to hire somebody to help them write their grant funding or their bids, they can just input some keywords, and this ChatGPT, I guess, equivalent would then sort of spin out some really useful text that you can then proofread and then use. So things like that encourages me to see that it's actually not all doom and gloom. That in fact there are some positive applications even at this early stage of development. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean it is, and it reminds me. I was yesterday. I was in Leeds talking at the Yorkshire Funders Forum conference, and I was doing a session. One of the things I was doing was a session on kind of emerging tech and philanthropy. Mm-hmm. We ended up having a big conversation about ChatGPT, and I showed them, you know, some examples, and some people were familiar with it already and others weren't, and I think they were quite blown away by what it can do.
Yeah.
And we ended up talking about exactly this question of, you know, clearly you could use this stuff for things like writing, you know, grant bids and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, initially you sort of think, oh, that feels a bit icky or problematic. And then you kind of think, well, actually, lots of organizations already use professional grant, you know, bid writing services or consultants. What is the fundamental difference? Mm-hmm. And then somebody made the point. He was like, actually, if you're a small organization that doesn't have, you know, professional capacity to write bids, or mm-hmm. you're an organization staffed by people who don't have English as a first language, actually, exactly. it can potentially be, you know, level the playing field in a, yeah. in a way and make it more fair and democratic. Yeah. So it's not an either or thing at all. No.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I'm guilty of running very long on this conversation.
I'm as guilty of that, sorry. Yeah,
but I would love actually just to hear some of your personal, because you've done so many podcasts, what, over 100, maybe even 200 by now.
If you took them all together, the CAF yeah. one and this one, we'd be up yeah. at around, yeah, sort of 160 probably. Yeah, yeah, so.
Do you have any sort of favourite sort of interview topics?
I don't know. I mean, I think in terms of guests, I'd have to take the sort of Bruce Forsyth approach of they're all my favorite. I think for me, in a way, the ones that yeah. It's a mixture. I think sometimes I get a lot out of a conversation because I can sort of hear it through from the perspective of the people listening. And so even though the topic might be quite familiar to me, because I spend all of my time thinking about this stuff and reading about it, it's, yeah. you know, I'm talking to somebody who's kind of making a point in a particularly compelling way. And I think, oh, this is brilliant. Yeah. And then other times it's something that's less familiar to me. And those in a way, I kind of, you know, I probably personally get more out of because they kind of surprise me. So I like, you know, I really enjoy the ones where I get to speak to people who've written a book that's maybe more about the history of philanthropy, because, you know, I learned something there. So I had a couple recently. So I interviewed Tyrone McKinley Freeman, who's written a great book about Madam C.J. Walker and you know, her philanthropy in kind of Jim Crow era America. And similarly, I spoke to Maribel Morey, who's another U.S. historian of philanthropy, a really interesting book about the Carnegie Corporation and the role they played in funding this famous report called An American Dilemma, all about race in America. So I really enjoy those. I had one really recently, which again, I really enjoyed because, I mean, partly on a personal level, I found him a really interesting interviewee, but also it was one of the smaller number of interviews with actual kind of substantive philanthropists I've had, because, you know, it's sort of harder to get those, but with a guy called Dr. Ewan Kirk, who it was an engineer and a Goldman Sachs partner, but he's got his own trust, and his whole thing is about risk and how actually philanthropy should be taking more risks and how you kind of let charities fail, but in a good way. So what it means to fail well. And I really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I happened to listen to that episode, and yeah, I found it just as interesting, because on the face of it, the title just made me jolt.
yeah, it's a bit counterintuitive.
As lawyers, I think we're naturally more risk averse, especially when giving advice to clients. So, you know, the headline of how charities should fail sort of was almost a dichotomy.
Yeah.
My way of thinking. But I really recommend checking that episode out, because there's a lot of value in what he said in that exchange. And I don't want to give it away, but it's not what it appears on paper, let's say. And certainly there's been so many great episodes that, you know, you've interviewed, that I've listened to, and I've subsequently bought a book. So Edgar Villanueva, Decolonizing Wealth, that was really, really good. Winners Take All by Anand Giridharadas. Hopefully I've said that right. And The Givers by David Callahan. So there's so many amazing people that have come onto your platform and you've had and shared discussions. On that, Rodri, do you have any sort of upcoming events you'd like to share with us?
Do I have upcoming events? I've just had a spate of events. One I've got coming up, if anybody's interested in the book and is in London, then next month, I think on the 10th of July, IG Advisors are doing one of their book club events about it. So I'll be in town talking about that in the evening, and there'll be some drinks and nibbles. I think there's still some tickets available. I'm not 100% sure, but do check that out. I mean, otherwise, if people want to, you know, to find me and stuff I'm doing and the podcast and things I've written, I mean, do check out Why Philanthropy Matters, the website. So it's just whyphilanthropymatters.com. And I'm sure I will have, you know, other speaking events coming up, in the next weeks and months.
Fantastic. Roger, I will share a link to where people can purchase your book, as well as if there are any tickets left for that event, I will share it in my show notes. On that note, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on, and it's a milestone, personal milestone for me in meeting you, even it's over Zoom, and I personally hope I can come to that signing event if I can get myself a ticket. So yeah, I really do recommend this book for those that can see it on the video. That just leaves me to say thank you for watching, and for those listening to this as a podcast, I hope you found our conversation informative and insightful, and I hope to catch you in our next episode. Okay, bye.
Bye.